Okay, great. So the Greg and Hiroshi asked me to give a two-lecture mini-course on aim maximization. It's great to be able to do that. And the way I decided to structure this is today I'll be talking purely about field theory results, no string duals or geometry or anything like that. On Thursday, I'll talk about aim maximization as it's been used in particularly in the context of toric geometry and the field theories dual to toric geometries. So I'll save all that for Thursday. Today is purely going to be field theory. The outline for today is I want to quickly review some salient features of four-dimensional n equals one superconformal field theories. I'll give just a bunch of different pieces of information that will be relevant for the rest of the talk here and just make sure everyone's on the same page. Then I'll move on to an ambiguity in the four-dimensional SCFTs that Ken and I resolved. Everything I'm talking about today is work I've done with Ken and Trilligator and how to resolve that ambiguity. And then finally, if we have time, I'll talk about C theorems in two dimensions and in four dimensions. Okay? So let me just start with, actually, not even with superconformal field theories. I probably don't need to motivate anybody in this audience that conformal field theories exist, but let me do this anyway. The possibility of a zero in the beta functions was actually first mentioned in the asymptotic freedom paper of Gross and Wilczek. But as far as I know, the first time that there was any evidence that a beta function could have a zero in some limit was done by Banks and Zaks in the early 80s. And they showed that there are actually some fixed points that you can access perturbatively. So Banks and Zaks demonstrated, I should say, the possibility of a conformal fixed point. Actually, why don't I just say of beta equals zero. And here, this fixed point was perturbatively accessible. Perturbatively. So how does this work? Well, let's say you just have the beta function for some gauge theory. I can write this like this up to two loops. And I can actually rig up by adjusting the matter content and the rank of the gauge group. I can rig up these coefficients such that, well, beta 1, this goes, let's say I have something like, for example, an SUNC theory with NF flavors. Roughly some number times NC minus some other number times NF. And by adding sufficient matter to this thing, I can arrange it so that this guy is order 1. And then typically, beta 2 will be order nc squared. And so if I solve this thing, I can now look for just the fact that these guys will have different signs means I can look, there's a possibility that this thing will be equal to 0 for some value of the coupling. So I just solve beta of g star equals 0. And you can see that then I'll get something which is like g star squared equals beta 1 over beta 2, which goes like 1 over nc squared. And if I take the large n limit, then I'll just pull 1 power of nc up here. I get g star squared nc goes like 1 over nc, which in the large n limit is small. So you'd expect that if you, of course, you have to worry about if you include higher order corrections to this beta function, if that fixed point will persist. But you'd expect that although the higher order corrections here would change the exact value of where this fixed point exists, they would not change the qualitative existence of a fixed point.
Is beta equals 0 implies scale invariance? Are you assuming scale invariance implies conformal?
Yeah, so here I'll assume that.
That's not always true.
I think there are no known counterexamples to that, right?
What about an
extra one? Yeah, no, I I don't know of any counterexamples to that. There's a paper of Joe Polchinski's where he investigates this, I know, and I think in every case it's found that if beta equals zero, then you get the full conformal invariant. Yes, sure. Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't know of any counterexamples. For the purposes of what I'm saying here, I will assume that beta equals zero implies you get the full conformal group as well. Okay, so this was just to motivate that you could possibly get some fixed point that exists, but of course it would be nice if that fixed point didn't have to be perturbatively accessible, right? You'd like, in a more general setting, to be able to say something about fixed points that exist in whatever regime. So if we want to take this away, if we want to go away from the perturbative regime, a good strategy is always to look at supersymmetric gauge theories where we actually have access to some exact results and may not have to rely on perturbation theory. So I want to go away from the perturbative regime here. So let's look from now on and for the rest of the talk, in fact, at supersymmetric gauge theories. I was not assuming anything about supersymmetry up until this point. Okay, so in supersymmetric gauge theories, in n equals 1, d equals 4, we actually know an exact beta function. Thanks to NSVZ. Yes. Well, no, sorry. This beta function is supposed to be good to all orders. In perturbation theory, yeah, that's right. And what this is, let me write the NSVZ on there. And I will not go through any sort of argument attempting to prove this. This okay, where G is the gauge coupling. These T's are just quadratic Casimirs, so T of some representation R is just, let me write this, that the trace of these two generators in some representation R is the Casimir times some delta function. This is the Casimir of the adjoint. And these are whatever matter fields I put in the gauge group. These are the anomalous dimensions of the matter field, which are, of course, dependent on the coupling. And I think that explains all the symbols. So you can see, just like in this earlier example I did over here, there's at least some hope that you may be able to get to some zero in the beta function.
So what happens to the pole of that function?
Yeah, someone always asks that. Unknown, I think. For everything, so where that pole is a scheme-dependent thing. So I'm going to assume that the pole is always going to be farther. If I'm letting my theory flow to some interacting conformal point, that pole is somewhere farther out, and basically I won't have to worry about it. It's a good question, but I think what's really going on with this pole is still extremely.
It certainly happens at some finite coupling, right?
Yeah, so it will happen at some finite G, but I'm going to assume, for the purpose of what I'm saying, is that any conformal point I hit is before you'd hit that pole. Yes, sorry, this is 3 T of G.
Do we know anything about
Let's see, I think, what's the result on this? I think in some cases you can get non-perturbative corrections. I don't know if there's a general result on that or if that's on a case-by-case basis. Yeah, I think in some cases you can get non-perturbative corrections to this. Okay. All right. So let me review other facts about. About n equals 1 SCFTs. All right, so number one, I had a particular order for these. The bosonic part, there's some super conformal algebra here. Which is SU22/1. And the bosonic part of this is just the usual 3 plus 1 dimensional conformal group. Plus, you're always guaranteed to have a U1R symmetry in there. It's just required. If you write down the generators of the superconformal algebra, you see that a U1 naturally pops out, which acts as an R symmetry. It does not commute with supersymmetry. All right, so this will be relevant because most of what I'm going to talk about today is how to find what this superconformal U1R is. There's a special one, and I'll keep coming back to this point. There's a special one that is singled out by the superconformal algebra that sits inside this SU221. And the point of what I'm saying will be how to find that R symmetry. There's a bound on the scaling dimension of operators. And this comes from unitarity. And this bound is simply that the exact scaling dimension of any gauge invariant operator has to be greater than or equal to 1. This is a requirement in any unitary conforming field theory. So let's see. This is saturated for free scalar operators. And again, gauge invariant. Okay, there's something else I can say about the dimension of any given operator, and that is there's a relationship between the dimension of the operator and the R charge of the operator. And in general, there's also a bound, which is that the scaling dimension of any operator is always going to be greater than or equal to, again, gauge invariant, greater than or equal to the absolute value of 3/2 times the R charge of that operator. And this is saturated with a plus sign for the case of chiral primary fields. For anti-chiral fields, there's an extra minus sign there. Saturated. So why don't I just say for chiral primaries, delta equals 3/2 R. And again, that comes directly out of the superconformal algebra. Okay, so notice what this means. This is, I can play a little game here. So if I look at the scaling dimension of some operator, let's say I write that as 1 plus the anomalous dimension over 2 for that operator. For a chiral primary, this is just equal to 3/2 times the R charge of that operator. So I can always rewrite my anomalous dimensions in terms of my R charges. And here I just multiply by 2 and move that over. So that gamma I, the anomalous dimension of whatever this operator it is equal to 3/2 times, sorry, it's 3RI minus 2. And now I can play a trick. I can plug this into the numerator of the NSBZ.
Are you talking about gauge and Markov operations?
Yeah, I was just worried about that. I think I'm being a little fast and loose here when I do this. I think you actually need to be more careful. So, let me. The issue is, when I said all this, I was talking about gauge invariant operators, but I'm actually going to apply this to the matter that I've put in the field theory, whatever like the variables I put in the original Lagrangian description were. So why am I allowed to use this in that case? Yeah. So when I'm thinking about this, I'm just summing over whatever, you know, I had a Lagrangian in terms of however many superfields.
Okay, I'm talking about the I. The I is going to have a different. I mean, in point four there, the I's are running over chiral primaries. And point one, they're running, in the Z, they're running over the fundamental fields.
Well, I'm treating those are the same. Here, the difference is the gate, whether or not I'm talking about gauge invariant operators or not. Right here, I really should be talking about gauge invariant operators when I make this statement and this statement.
No other,
I'm sorry. Am I incorrect about this?
I think you don't need to have gauge invariant operators to have delta. So
this is definitely, this is only for gauge invariant operators.
But that one, I thought, is for all.
Yes, so I'm sorry, you're...
I thought the bound comes from the representation theory of the conformal group. And
both these bounds...
This is true only for field power state.
Yeah.
Gauge invariant state can be...
So the chiral primary. The question. Then it's okay.
Do you allow gauge non invariant operators?
Yeah, because over here, the question is, why am I allowed to use this formula in here if I'm just putting in the original chiral superfields that are the degrees of freedom? They're clearly non-invariant operators. Well, I think that's the, at the end of the day, once I play this trick, that's going to be the correct statement, is that this will end up being an anomaly, which will be protected. There are many other ways to argue what I'm about to argue as well. So I think what I'm saying here, I think, is not rigorous. What I'm about to do by plugging this in there.
Will you maybe take n copies of this same field?
And they get baryons out of them or whatever.
Just multiply everything by n, and then the other. Because they are chiral primaries, they are projective. Then you divide by n.
Yeah, maybe that's the right thing to do.
Because if you have many fields, you can construct chiral. You can construct gauge invariant chiral primaries.
Sure. So maybe what I actually want to do here is look at the anomalous dimension of the baryon operator that I construct out of these guys. That might be the right way of doing it.
Typically, you look at mesonic operators. They are the one that can violate the bound. So they are excluded.
Well, anything can violate this bound. Anything can violate this bound. What do I want to say? Whenever you have anything that violates this bound, it's a problem. Right, and when you're doing A maximization, you find typically only mesonic operators that violate this bound. But in principle, you could have a problem with the baryonic operators as well. Typically, you only get a problem with the mesons. But all right, let me keep going with this illegitimate thing I'm about to do, and then we can argue about how to make it rigorous later.
Is this using tree-level or?
I'm sorry. This is the exact anomalous dimension. This is the exact scaling dimension.
Gamma will change.
The point is that I'm going to show you how to sum, in some sense, get the number for what this anomaly is, for what this exact scaling dimension is. Yeah.
Nevertheless, you're saying that gamma is not independent.
Well, I'm saying that when I sum, this is a physical quantity, right? This is a physically measurable thing. So I'm going to come up. The anomalous dimension is also some physically measurable thing, which, you know, if you write it out in terms of the coupling, sure, that'll be scheme dependent, etc., and get corrections from all orders. Yeah. The coupling constant is at some value in whatever scheme I've picked. Right, which is some... The whole question of scheme dependence here is a very subtle one, because it's unclear what scheme this NSBZ beta function is considered in. If you ask people, typically they'll say the NSBZ scheme, which is basically a tautology. So I think it's not clear how to reproduce this thing from just perturbative calculation to higher loops. Yeah, so I'm claiming I will sum, this is evaluated at the conformal point. There's a number that I can calculate for these guys. Okay. So let's plug into NSBZ, just the numerator.
I'm sorry, I'm really.
Yes. Yeah.
You're saying something about the nature of the chiral ring. You're saying that it is a generator of the chiral ring of matter.
No.
Then why is the index I and the formula for beta and u the same as the index I and your
Yeah, this is a very legitimate point. Let's talk about this later, because this is essentially what I'm doing here is just a trick to motivate something that you can show regardless of.
Just by saying that we conjecture that the generators of the tunnel ring are in the first
I don't think that is right at all. I don't think that statement is not true. So, again, what I'm...
Well, you can use different index.
Yeah. Okay. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to claim I can plug this expression. Sorry. What I'm going to do is I'm going to plug this expression there, and you'll see something that's suggested. As soon as I write that down, I'll argue another way that...
You assume that somehow there's a fundamental field.
That I can treat the fundamental fields as chiral primary. Yeah. The statement is not that... Well, the more I say about this, the more it gets away from the main point of the talk. This is not a rigorous argument I'm going through now.
J, then you shouldn't put a 1 there.
What? I'm just defining the anomalous. Oh, so maybe there's an N there or something you're saying? Or what? Okay, look. Yeah, let's continue to argue about this later. I agree that I'm not being rigorous here, right? All I want to motivate is that there's some connection, and then I'll explain another way of thinking about it. Okay. All right, so now I'm actually going to do this. So if I plug this in, I kind of close my eyes momentarily and hope for the best. What I'm going to get is, well, now I can just plug in this expression for the anomalous dimension, and I actually get this thing. All right, for the numerator of the, for this part of the NSVZ beta function. And the point is that this is equal to 3 times what this is just an anomaly, an ABJ anomaly for the R symmetry. Okay? This is the gay genos, and this is all the matter fields that have some R charge. Now the R charge of the fermionic component of the chiral superfield is 1 less than the R charge of the scalar component. By RI here I really mean the R charge of the scalar component. And so these are just the fermions that are going around in the triangle diagram with one R current and then 2 gauge bosons. So this is 3 times the ABJ anomaly. for U1R. Okay, and the point is that since this thing vanishes, right, because I'm at a conformal point, the statement is that this U1R is anomaly free. But this is really nothing more than something I already knew from the superconformal algebra, which is that I'm guaranteed to have a good R symmetry, because it's necessarily a part of the superconformal algebra. This is just another way of saying that I must have of showing that there's some connection between being at a superconformal point and showing that I have an anomaly free R symmetry.
That just seems to imply that there cannot be non-perturbative corrections to the
SPC. So you are probably assuming that at this conformal point, there's a description of the theory in terms of, an adaptive description in terms of some fundamental primary at that point.
Yeah, so I mean, initially I think that's a valid statement, is that there's a weakly coupled description I have in terms of things that I'm treating as chiral primaries. Of course, this will change as I go down to the IR, as I let this thing flow. All right, there's another way you can state this as well, is that you can invent a superfield, or show that there is a superfield, the super stress tensor, which contains the stress tensor and the R current. And similarly, by messing around with that, you can come up with a superfield that contains the trace of the stress tensor and the divergence of the R current. And therefore, if one vanishes by supersymmetry, the other has to vanish as well. So there's a superfield. Also, there's a superfield. Often this is written T alpha alpha dot with, I'll be a little bit loose with indices. We're contracting these with thetas and things, so don't worry about it too much right now, with the stress tensor and the R current. And similarly, there's one with the trace of the stress tensor and the divergence of the R current. These are related by supersymmetry. If one vanishes, the other has to vanish as well. This is, again, just a statement that if I'm at a superconformal point, I'm guaranteed to have an R symmetry. Okay, so what else do I want to say? There's one other point I want to mention, which is that actually I can compute the central charges of this superconformal field theory just with global anomalies. So it turns out that, remember that in 2D, the trace of the stress tensor, you can... Sure. Yeah, so the question, the subtlety is which R current you mean in some sense. And what I'm saying is there is some, like there's two different currents that, this is the UV R current, and then there's this Kanishi current as well. Right, and there's some linear combination of those that's really the thing that is in the same multiplet as of the stress tensors. You just need to be careful about which current you need. And what it is, there's some linear combination. The statement is that there's a linear combination of those two currents. That linear combination depends on the anomalous dimension that is conserved. And that's the R current that I'm talking about here. So yeah, but you do need to be subtle with that. This is not the ultraviolet R current. There's a different R current that's conserved. So in 2D, one way you can see the central charge is if you look at the expectation value of the trace of the stress tensor on some curved background, right? In 2D, basically the only game in town is the Ricci scalar. You can see the central charge show up here. In 4D, you can also see some central charges, which, roughly speaking, I'm not going to record exact coefficients. You have another central charge that can come into the game in four dimensions. You actually have a lot more and then have to argue that those guys aren't important or aren't there for whatever reason. But at the end of the day, after a somewhat subtle argument, you end up with two possibilities here. And these guys are called C and A. C multiplies something like a vial density, and A, the other one called A, multiplies an Euler density. All right. So in 4D, you just have two more possibilities. And it turns out that you can use, again, supersymmetry to actually compute these things in terms of traces of, I'm pointed to that R, but I meant this R, in terms of traces of R charges. So you can use SUSY to compute C and A, and this is a result of, I think it's Anselmi, Ehrlich, Friedman, and Johansson from 97 or 98, that says that the central charge A and the central charge C are related to global anomalies by this. Let's see, so here there's a 9 trace R cubed minus, I think it's a 5 trace R in this case. So you can actually use supersymmetry to compute A and C. And the point is that since these are global anomalies, you can use the Tuft anomaly matching to compute these in some weakly coupled regime and then trust that those numbers will not change as you flow down to the infrared. Yeah, so for example, I mean, it's the sum over, what I want to say, if I have a bunch of, so trace R, for example, if I sum over all the, let's say the matter, well, I should put gauge notes in here too, but just in terms of the interesting stuff, the matter, this is the dimension of whatever representation that guy is going to be in times the R charge minus 1. Okay, and again, here I'm doing it for the fermionic component. All right. This is manifestly not, by the way, the ABJ anomaly. This is actually just summing over all the different R charges for everything. There's no... So I can go. I guess I'm going a little bit slower than I wanted. I can argue for where this comes from later, but for right now, let me just state that result and move on. But it's actually not too hard to see where this comes from. It's basically if you write the super trace anomaly, you get that in the. If I kind of supersymmetrize this whole thing, I guess I'll just say it, but I won't write it down. If you supersymmetrize this whole equation, what you see is that the Weyl and the Euler pieces pick up stuff which are like R dual. So you'll get so this guy is related to the R current by supersymmetry. Here you'll get things that look like curvature, and R, and that's where you get the trace R and the trace R cubed. Those are each proportional to some coefficient of C and A. If you reverse that thing around, then you get A and C in terms of those global anomalies. So it's basically just writing this trace anomaly in some manifestly supersymmetric way. Okay, so I think that's done for the review, and really kind of something that you see a lot in what I've just written is that the R symmetry is a very useful thing if you have it at your disposal. It gives you dimensions of chiral primaries and anti-chiral primaries. It gives you central charges. It gives you all this different stuff. So if you can identify the superconformal U and R, and that's, again, something important to say here, is that everything I'm talking about with this R symmetry is specifically for the R symmetry inside the superconformal group. If you can identify which R symmetry is inside the superconformal group, you have a lot of information at your disposal. Okay, so sometimes this is easy to do. Sometimes this is easy. Easy to identify the U1R inside the superconformal group. And the easiest example I can think of is just SUNC, SQCD with NF flavors. And by NF flavors, I mean NF fundamentals and NF anti-fundamentals. And so in this case, you can use symmetries. There's a flavor symmetry which says that all the different colors have to have have to have the same R charge. And then there's a charge conjugation symmetry that says that the fundamentals and anti-fundamentals have to have the same R charge. So here you can say that R of Q, the flavors I'll call Q and Q tilde, R of Q is actually equal to R of Q tilde. And so there's really only one R charge in the game, which means you have one equation that the R charge, that the R symmetry be anomaly free, let this thing vanish, and one R charge to plug in. So here anomaly freedom fixes the R charge. And you can just write it down. NC plus NF R of Q minus 1 equals 0. So I just solve for the R charge, and I'm done. Minus NC over NF. So this is a case where I can actually use the symmetries to write down the R charge uniquely. Here, there's no ambiguity. But you can even think of a simple example where there is a problem. And that's, let's say I just take the same theory. By the way, something I should have said here, there's no super potential. I take the same theory only with an adjoint. Yeah?
Could I just go back to this, what you just said?
Sure.
So anomaly freedom, you mean no anomalous R prime?
Yeah, I mean there's no... Yeah, that's right. So it's the Adler-Belgacheve anomaly for the R current vanishing.
That again, if you say it's equivalent to...
That is a requirement if you're at a superconformal fixed point.
So it's not actually equivalent?
Well, you can... No, it's not. You can come up with an R current that is conserved and not necessarily be at a superconformal point.
So are you assuming here that you're at a...
Here I'm saying... Yeah, okay, right. Thank you. Absolutely. Here I'm saying, what I didn't say is I'm in some range of colors and flavors where this, I'm assuming this theory is flowing to a conformal point. So what I really should have said here is that I'm inside the conformal window for SQCD. So NF is in between 3/2 NC and 3 NC. Okay, that's it's a crucial point, is that there is a conformal, an interacting conformal theory in the infrared to which I'm flowing. And of course, as is well known, in SQCD that's not true if I have a if I'm outside of the conformal window. So really here, I mean that I'm in the conformal window. Yeah, thank you. No. This is a fundamental, this is an adjoint. So the chasm here is 1, right? Or 1/2. And there's NF. There's 2 NF of those guys. Here, the chasm here of the adjoint is NC. Okay? And then I have NF times 2 times 1/2 there. All right, so here's a simple example where the R symmetry is not uniquely determined by symmetries. Is I just take that same example plus an adjoint matter field X. So I can just throw this into, I mean, I still have this, again, let's say there's no super potential, I'm in some range where the theory is going to flow to some conformal fixed point in the infrared. Here I can write down the anomaly free equation again. I get NC plus NC R of X minus 1 plus NF R of Q minus 1 equals 0. And the point in all this is just saying that, look, here you have one equation for anomaly freedom and two undetermined R charges. So there's manifestly an ambiguity here. The problem, though, is that there is not an ambiguity here. There is a special U1 that's singled out by the conformal algebra. So we're missing something. So here's a one-parameter family. Of R symmetries. That appear to be, that are anomaly free, which one of these is inside SU22/1? So this is the problem. Let me restate this problem in another way. One way of saying this is that actually you have a number of different U1s that could potentially mix in with the R symmetry. And the question is then to find the correct linear combination of U1s that is actually inside the superconformal algebra. So said another way, so So equivalently, the question is which linear combination of U1s is the superconformal U1R. In other words, as a guess for your R symmetry, RT, I'll call that for trial, you could put any R symmetry you want. It's anomaly free. If you have a superpotential, the superpotential has R charge 2, plus any linear combination, these SIs are just some real parameters, times other U1 flavor symmetries in the theory. So this I runs over all, let's say, anomaly free, because you want this R charge, R current to be anomaly free, U1 flavor symmetries. Now, what the question is, what are the appropriate values of SI such that this is inside the superconformal algebra? So this is just stating it here. Where the other U1 comes from is just the global U1 that comes by putting this field X. All right, so the solution is A maximization. And so this is what Ken and I did. And it turns out that there are additional consistency conditions on this conformal field theory, on the superconformal field theory, that you're not taking into account if you just stop here. And I'll just state the answer, and then I'll motivate why it works, is that the correct, let me say it this way, the correct values of these parameters, or SI, are given, are, what am I going to say, where the function A trial, which will basically just be that A over there. Is it still there? Yeah. That central charge A. I'll keep it 330 seconds here just for fun. Or where this function has a local max. Okay? So in order to find these parameters, SI, all you do is you take this function, the cubic function, it'll have one local maximum. At that point, those are the correct values of the SIs. And by plugging those in, those give you exactly the superconformal U1R symmetry. So let me explain why this works. I'm saying it's unique, yeah. That this has uniquely one local maximum in all those parameters, yeah. If I had two here, I slice the function in that direction, it wouldn't be a cubic in that direction anymore. Right? Yeah, but I can always, if you want, I can always pick some basis which is linear in between those two, and then it still needs to be a cubic function in between those two numbers. Okay, so let me, before I actually explain why this is true, let me just do the simplest example you can possibly think of. Yeah, but because of its Swift anomaly matching, these are all global anomalies, so I can use them wherever I want. Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So I can only really, I write down, what I do is I look at the, there's an important point that this brings up, which is that I start with some weakly coupled description in the ultraviolet, and I write down, you know, I have a superpotential, whatever, I figured out what the good global symmetries of that theory are, I assign some charges to make everything work out, and then I do this. Now, if you can't identify all the global U1s, if there are some accidental symmetries that come up in the infrared, then this procedure does not work. This is contingent on being able to identify all the U1s that show up. So if there are accidental symmetries, this will not give you the correct answer. And there are actually several examples that maybe if I have time later, I'll talk about.
You include central symmetry, then this statement of magnetization is correct.
Yes.
No bother.
Yeah. I mean, but you have to be able to identify all the axes. The problem is that you can't often identify the axial symmetry.
So this is
if you knew what all the, if you knew the entire symmetry group in the infrared, this is exactly correct. Yeah, I agree. But the problem is that, with regards to Hiroshi's question, if you're computing things in the ultraviolet, you might be missing something if you don't know the axial symmetry.
But when you make the experiment, you don't need to know the ultraviolet.
But sometimes that's the only description you have.
In practice.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. I'm talking about in practice. Absolutely. No, that's right. This description is not. I mean, if I knew the whole symmetry group, this is exactly right. Computing this in practice, if you can't identify the charges, then you can't identify the. Then you will get the wrong answer.
Then you identify the anomaly.
Yeah, you start in some description where you know all the degrees of freedom, etc., and you assign charges to make all these guys anomaly free, for example. Right, these better be all anomaly free if you want in order to make the whole thing anomaly free. So you start up in the ultraviolet where you know some weakly coupled description, you assign all your charges, but then because of a Tift anomaly matching, those actual numbers, whatever you compute here, right, when you solve for these, you'll just get something in terms of global anomalies. It might be some horrible, horrible expression, but it will be entirely in terms of global anomalies. That number will be the same. I'm sorry? Well, okay, so if it could be this irregular tab case. Absolutely. So let me do the simplest example, which you don't need me to do. Say I have a free chiral superfield phi. Let me just call it R charge little r, just to show you how this thing works. And it's exactly what you'd think. Here, there's just nothing interesting. There's no trace. It's not a gauge theory. It's just some chiral superfield. And so a trial, in this case, is a function of r. This is 3 r minus 1 cubed minus r minus 1. This has extrema at r equals 2/3 and 4/3, and the max is at r equals 2/3. Which is, I mean, you didn't need this to tell you to it. It's just a free field. It has dimension 1. It has r charge 2/3. But the point is that, really, it's no more difficult for extremely exotic interacting theories, right? It's still, in principle, solving a bunch of cubic equations, which you can, I mean, often solving them, getting some closed form solution, some analytic solution is difficult, but you can always solve these guys, as we've had to do in many recent examples, numerically. Okay, so let me just talk about the proof of this statement very, very quickly. So the proof of this statement is really, it's all it is just reducing this, the fact that this function is at some maximum, to two equivalent statements, one that it's at an extremum, one that that extremum is actually a maximum, and proving that those have to be satisfied in any 4dn equals 1 SCFT. So the extremum statement, if I just take one derivative here, right, and then set it equal to 0, it's that 9 trace that the superconformal U1R will satisfy for any flavor symmetry. This is taking the derivative with respect to any of these SIs. Equals trace FI. Okay, and this is a requirement. Well, what I will argue right now is that this is actually required to be satisfied in any SCFT. So just to sketch the argument is to give a very, very fast and loose sketch of why this is true, is imagine I have the following triangle diagram with three global currents, a flavor current over here, and then two R currents. By supersymmetry, these R currents, this is going to be some, you know, you can construct some super three-point function here. Somewhere in this three-point function, by supersymmetry, there'll be something with just one flavor current and then two stress tensors, because the R current and the stress tensor are related by supersymmetry. This is up to some numerical coefficient tells you that there's some relationship between the left-hand side of this equation, bearing in mind you have to be a lot more careful than this, the left-hand side over here with two R currents and a flavor, and here with just one flavor and then two gravitons, which just gives you the trace of F. So if you're very careful, you can argue that there actually has to be a 9 here. And in fact, there's a result due to Osborne that in any n equals 1 SCFT, this super three-point function, which has a super flavor current and then super stress tensors, is determined. The tensor structure of that thing is determined up to an overall coefficient, so that any of the different components of it should have some theory-independent relationship. In particular, you can check this for a free theory where everything has R charge 2/3. The R charge you would put in here would then be the R charge of the fermionic component, which would be minus 1/3. This exactly cancels off, because then you'd get minus 1/3 squared here. So you can, that's another way of convincing yourself that that 9 has to be correct. Yeah. I mean, these are just related by supersymmetry as well. Right, I mean, there's just... There's no... This is just supersymmetry, but the existence of an R current here is... You don't have that R current around, a conserved R current, unless you're at a... necessarily have one around unless you're at a superconformal fixed point. And the other part, that you're at an extremum, is a similar type of story. Sorry, that you're at a maximum. It's just that the second derivative of this thing vanishes, then this term cancels out. All you've got is that now you'll take the second derivative with respect to two of the different SIs. That translates to, at a maximum, what you want is the eigenvalues of this thing, viewed as a matrix in I and J, to be less than zero. And the way this argument goes through, again being a little bit sloppy, is that this is going to be related to a three-point function with a stress tensor here. You could argue now that because you're at a superconformal point, that that three-point function with a stress tensor is actually related to a two-point function with just the two flavor currents in there. And that two-point function of two flavor currents in a CFT has a definite sign. So if you work out the coefficient very carefully, you argue that this is... It turns out there's a minus 1/3 here. This is related to a two-point function with two flavor currents. This is some positive definite thing. There's an overall minus sign over there. That means you always have to be at a maximum. Okay? And again, you can check this minus 1/3 by plugging in a free field. So that's the proof. There are other ways of viewing this thing in terms of super anomalies, et cetera, that I can get into later, but I don't want to talk about right now. Okay. So let me see, what else did I want to say? I will make one quick comment here. This basically gets me through the first two sections of the talk. So let me make one quick comment, and then I'll see if people want to hear more. The one comment I want to make is that whenever you're writing down these U1 charges, you can always originally pick some basis in which you're solving by maximizing this function here. You're solving a set of equations with rational coefficients. So all the R charges of the chiral primaries, all the dimensions of chiral primaries, all the central charges, etc., all have to actually be algebraic numbers. This is a necessary condition in any four-dimensional n equals one superconformal field theory. This is a consequence of A maximization. So, for example, those can't depend on any continuous moduli. So it's just a necessary statement for any 4D n equals 1 SCFT. And we have many examples now of, there are these examples that came out a while ago of these Sasaki-Einstein metrics with quadratic irrational R charges that led to quadratic irrational R charges on the gauge theory side. And we also have examples where you get quartic roots, et cetera. So that's one of the consequences of A maximization here. Really, this is the point of everything I've said so far is just to resolve this ambiguity and realize that in practice, this is a very simple algorithm to do. You can throw it on a computer in like 30 seconds, and then you may not be able to solve things exactly, but certainly numerically, you can get out R charges. And that's where really these have been used a lot recently. In fact, even exact answers have been used a lot recently to check with ADS-CFT. Because now, thanks to something I'll talk about on Thursday, we can actually compute something on the geometry side, which should match up exactly with these R charges. Okay? So this gets me through the part of the talk that up until talking about C theorems in two and four dimensions. Now we're exactly at an hour here. So I'll leave it up to you guys what you want me to do. I can keep going or I can just stop and whatever.
I think we can start that when people welcome to the meeting.
Yeah, that sounds great. So let me just plug what I'm going to do on Thursday, which is to talk about what's been touted as the geometric dual on the string theory side of A-maximization, specifically in the context of toric geometries. So I'll talk about that, and I'll also talk about recent techniques due to the brain tilings and dimer that allow us to construct a whole family of ABS-CFT dual geometries and quiver gauge theories. So that's what I'll do next time, and use all this A-maximization technology to check that we're actually getting the right answer.
Are you going to need what you want to say about the theorem on Thursday?
No, that's an independent thing.
Okay, so maybe we can have some breaking points here.
Yeah, why don't we do that, and everyone who's bored can leave.
Okay,
and anyone who wants to. Now's your chance. Yeah, this is. Okay, why don't we take a 5-minute break? That way you can slip out like 10 minutes, I'd say. Well, it depends how much more, also on questions, but I'd say roughly those 10 minutes. Okay, I'll just. Are they leaving? Someone poke. All right, I'll just continue. I'm being pulled in both directions. It's okay. All right, so let me talk about this procedure. A-maximization has a lot of relevance for proving an analog of the C-theorem in four dimensions. So let me talk about that now. All right, so C-theorems, this was the third section. In 2D and 4D. Now, in 2D, there's really not too much to say. There is a C theorem. It always works. So what's the C theorem in 2D? Zamolodchikov. Am I spelling this correctly? Maybe. All right. Proved that there exists a quantity C such that, okay, well, what does this thing do? If you start up in the ultraviolet, you deform the theory by some relevant operator, you let it flow down to the infrared. There's some quantity, and also let's say that as this thing flows down, let me define, well, let me just say this. ddt c of g is less than 0, where t equals minus log mu. So t runs from minus infinity to plus infinity as you go from infinity to 0, say, in mu. And that this is a monotonically decreasing function along the renormalization for flow. That, moreover, at these conformal fixed points, C of G star is the central charge of whatever conformal field theory you have sitting up here or down there. So you have some function. You prove the existence of some function which interpolates between the two central charges and is monotonically decreasing.
There must be some more. I mean,
in a unitary renormalizable.
There's a formula for this function. I mean, otherwise, the statement is empty. If I give you a vector here, that can always construct a function.
No, I don't think that's. I mean, you want it to agree with the central charges at both those points.
And
I mean, you can actually construct this function in terms of.
I think the point is that the C is given by data, can be constructed by data given to you from the field theory.
Okay. Well, yes. Yeah, certainly. You could just... Yeah, I mean, you construct... The proof is you write this thing in terms of two-point functions and things like that. So, yeah, I see what... It's not just some arbitrary function having to do... It has stuff that has to do with the filter. So there's something else that is true also. He proved even a little stronger statement than this, at least if you were close to the perturbative, close to a conformal fixed point, which is that not only is this thing monotonic, this is actually, this flow is gradient flow, and that the beta functions are driven by gradients of the central charge. So also, moreover, he showed that, and again, this is not an exact result. He showed this perturbatively, although it may be true exactly. We don't know. He showed that beta, maybe let me write this, beta I of, let's say I just have one, well, I don't want too many indices around here. Beta I of the ith coupling G is some metric times the gradient of the central charge. And he actually showed that this is some positive definite metric, which is basically just a two-point function of different operators in the theory. And if you write it out, you can see that if this thing is positive definite, this thing being positive definite actually implies that this guy is less than zero, right? DC dt equals, let's see, what do I want to say? Is dc dg dg dt, but this is minus, let me write it in the same order, dc dgi, then minus t is there, because t is minus log mu, that's the minus sign of the beta function, beta ij dc, sorry, g, dij, which, if that thing is positive, makes this manifestly negative. Okay, so that's in two dimensions. Now the question is, what about in four dimensions? Oh, something else about the central charge I forgot to say, because I said it, oh, it's over here still, is that you can read off the central charge from the excitation value of the trace of the stress tensor. Now in four dimensions, as I wrote over here, you simply have more options for a central charge. So the question is, in four dimensions, which, if any, of these obeys a C theorem? And something else I should have said is that here, really, this is a quantitative way. It makes precise the idea that the degrees of freedom should decrease along where normalization group flow. This quantity C has a nice interpretation as degrees of freedom. The question is there something like this in four dimensions? Is one of these morally like the degrees of freedom? And if so, does it decrease along where normalization group flow? And this is still an open question. So in 4D, as I said over there, let me just rewrite it, but not go into any more detail. You have two central charges, which one, Cardy suggested, pick A. And you can actually show simple flows where C increases along the normalization group flow. But so far, in every known example, It's this coefficient of the Euler density, A, that is known to decrease along with normalization as well. He said pick A. Yeah, there's a paper from, I think it's 74, called Is There a C Theorem in Four Dimensions? And he suggests that it's actually A. Yeah. It's not 74? When is it?
It's after Thermological, I guess. Thermological is 86.
No.
No, the paper of Cardi, I think it should be after the paper of...
Yeah, okay, I'm getting that year wrong.
Even I remember that paper.
Okay, I'm getting the year wrong.
No.
Sorry, it's not 74, good point. All right, so Cardi, in a time that nobody remembers, suggested that it was A. Okay. So now the question is, well, can we use, Zamolodikov's proof of the C theorem, it's a very simple proof, right? It uses, just says, hey, we've got some unitary, we're normalizable, field theory. Can we, and just from that, proves that there's this quantity C dependent on things in the field theory. In four dimensions, you'd like there to be an equally simple proof for unitary renormalizable theory. But so far, this has been completely elusive. And in fact, the attempt to use techniques that are used in two dimensions has, what to say about this? It's not clear that actually works out too well. There are a lot of subtleties in regulating things. And it's not clear that there's an attempt by Forte and Latorre to prove this. It's not clear that this is actually, that proof actually works. So far, I think it's widely accepted that there is no general proof of the now so-called A theorem. I mean, it's called the A theorem, but it's not a theorem. There's no widely accepted proof. I'll just say no proof, knowing that this is being recorded. Okay, so the question is, well, can we say anything about a C-theorem, the A-theorem in four dimensions? And all I want to do to motivate this is that A-maximization, at least in the case of supersymmetric gauge theories, offers not a complete proof, but at least a start to how to attack the A-theorem in four dimensions. So my claim... I'll just go over here. My claim is that A maximization almost proves the A theorem. So A maximization, I don't know why I capitalized that, almost proves let's say, for the moment, the weakest form of the A theorem, which is just that A in the infrared is less than A in the ultraviolet. You could get stronger and stronger forms. Weakest is that infrared is less than ultraviolet. Next strongest is that there's something that interpolates. The next strongest is that it's actually gradient flow with some positive definite metric. There's been progress on all of those, actually, but let me just motivate the weakest form right now. So here's the idea. Okay. This is a very handy phrase. All right, so it's a two-line proof. So the statement is this. Okay, let's say you start in the ultraviolet, and then you deform the theory by some relevant operator. You flow down to the infrared. Typically, that will break some of the flavor symmetries. So the flavor symmetries in the infrared are some subset of the flavor symmetries in the ultraviolet. So let me denote this. Let me use this to denote all the flavor symmetries in the infrared, some subset, typically, of the flavor symmetries in the ultraviolet. If you're about to object, don't. Okay, well, what does this mean? Well, when we were doing, we're maximizing, right? We're finding some local maximum. So here we're maximizing over some subset of the original parameter space. So you would expect that would lead to a decrease in the maximum. But maximizing over a subset of the original SI means the max will decrease. And again, if you're about to object, don't. So, okay, there's two lines in this proof, and I can think of exactly two things wrong with this proof. And the first is that statement one is not true. So one is not true because of accidental symmetries. Right? Typically, you can have symmetries that crop up in the infrared that you could not have seen in the ultraviolet, or that we don't know how to see in the ultraviolet. Okay? So this is not a true statement. The flavor symmetries in the ultra-red are not, in general, a subgroup of the flavor symmetries in the ultraviolet. Okay. And number two, okay, this would be true if this were a global maximum, but it's only a local maximum when you do a maximization because it's a cubic function. So there's no guarantee that maximizing over some subset doesn't, you know, push you up the hill of the cubic somewhere and end you up larger than you started originally. Right, so two is not true. because it's only a local max. So there's two objections. One of these is a very difficult thing to deal with, the other of which is a relatively easy thing to deal with. And in fact, two, at least not in full generality, but at least in many cases where you still need to worry about it. So two has been resolved. By Kutuzov. Let me just not qualify that statement, even though it should be qualified. There's still some cases where we need to worry about it. And one is difficult, except for the case of accidental symmetries coming from things that look like unitarity bound violations that where the dimensions of operators look like they're getting less than one, except for the case of where the dimensions of gauge invariant operators look like they're being less than one. And the statement here, I won't go into any details because I want to wrap this up. So Seiberg says, even in SQCD, right, you see these operators like QQ tilde, that if you let it run below NF equals 3 halves NC, look like they're violating the unitarity bound. So Seiberg claims that what should happen there is when an operator, when a gauge invariant operator looks like it's violating the unitarity bound, there's actually an accidental symmetry that comes and acts only on that operator, pulls its dimension back up to 1, and then that operator decouples from the rest of the theory. So this is the kind of, and of course in SQCD, that's a special case where the whole theory somehow becomes free when NF is less than 3 halves NC. In general, you can think of many cases where you have operators that are violating the unitarity bound, but the whole theory doesn't become free. And this case was dealt with. This was for these accidental symmetries. These were solved by Kutuzov, Parnachev, and him, David Sahakian. Where they showed how to modify the A maximization principle to take these symmetries into account. And it's really pretty straightforward. And it's extremely necessary. It's important to do this. If you don't do this, then you'll get the wrong answer in a number of cases, and things that you think might be relevant actually aren't relevant, etc. The central charge you should use is, instead of maximizing the original A, basically what you do is you subtract off the degrees of freedom from the operator that's violating the unitarity bound and put in the degrees of freedom of a free operator. And so 2/9 is just what you get if you plug 2/3 into this thing and in brackets here. And so the claim is that if you ever have an operator that looks like it's hitting the unitarity bound, below where that thing hits the unitarity bound, this is the thing you should be doing A maximization on, not the original one. And there are many examples in these guys' paper where this yields quantitatively and qualitatively different results. So this is an important thing to take into account. However, in general, there are many other types of accidental symmetries that you don't have control over unless you have some kind of weakly coupled dual description, like Seiberg duality, right? There are a number of examples we've worked out where using Seiberg duality, we actually know a dual theory, and you can see things by doing A maximization in the weakly coupled dual. You can see that you're getting the wrong answer by doing A maximization in the originals on the electric side. So in general, accidental symmetries are a hard problem. If you like, you can say that number one is equivalent to solving the problem of finding a weakly coupled dual for any gauge theory, right, for any supersymmetric gauge theory, which is a very difficult problem. Sergio.
So if you do that procedure for super QCD, when you know that there is a free Seiberg dual phase, you get the A for the Seiberg dual?
If in super QCD, below NF equals 3 halves NC, the whole thing is free. And so you still don't even get the right answer there, because actually you should be getting the A for everything being free.
This works if the
theory is not free and you have an operator hitting the unitarity bound.
For example, if you have a, say, so you look at the operators, what is happening with some mesons will become really well, like this bomb. Then you should basically play the bear free, and then you should basically do this procedure to get the
out. Is there an independent check of this procedure?
Well, you can do this level kind of job.
There's no proof. But this is, I think, an equivalent question. There's no proof that once an operator hits R charge 2/3 and the axonal symmetries, Seibert's prescription saying the axonal symmetries act only on this operator and keep it at R charge 2/3, there's no proof of that statement.
Is there an independent check you were saying about some type
there is this other kind of duality because this SQCD is with algorithm, but of course, It provides some checks, but it doesn't.
Here's one way of saying this, Sergio. You can look at the conformal window of this theory he's talking about and compute A in the electric description using this prescription. Okay. Then you can look at the weakly coupled dual and compute it using there'll be some regime in the magnetic theory which you needed to incorporate all of these corrections in for all the operators hitting the bound, but you didn't need to worry about them in the magnetic theory. Everything checks fine in that case. So, I mean, I could go into more detail here, but I think I better stop and say that the primary holdup for proving the A theorem now, even in the case of supersymmetric gauge theories, is accidental symmetry. It's a very difficult question in general. And as far as I know, there are no good ideas out there for dealing with this right now. So, let me stop there.
In some sense, it should suggest that there should be a different proof. I mean, a completely different proof.
Well, yeah.
Because I cannot see how you can make much progress on this.
No. I think it's... I don't see how you can make much progress on this either. But, I mean, the... So there's another possibility, too, which is that A isn't the right thing to use.
Yeah,
right. In fact, there are other competing prescriptions. There's this thermal C function of Applequist et al. That you can really only... I don't think there are any counterexamples to that, but I don't think you can compute it anywhere except in a free theory. I don't think there, as far as I know, there are no counter. There might be. I don't honestly know his program that well.
Yeah, since you increase the temperature, this is a thermal function. The computational power is lower substantially.
Yeah.
And the inside why it should be Euler and not mono? Use very much the convention of gravity. If you couple the super, except for why you have a confidence on.
Yeah, I don't have any intuitive picture why the coefficient of the vial is the wrong one. It is true that there are many counterexamples of that, but I don't have any intuitive reason for saying it should be Euler rather than Weyl.
How about three dimensions? There's no present.
Yeah, so...
Another quantity?
Three dimensions, nothing is known, basically, about three dimensions. First of all, there's no, there's no anomalies, right? There's no trace anomaly in three dimensions. I shouldn't say there's no anomaly. There's no trace anomaly in three dimensions. As far as I know, nothing is really known about the C theorem in three dimensions.
No other candidate function.
You can mention the volume of the
seven. Yeah. So I was. You can check this, but we don't know anything about those gauge theories, right?
So the statement is that the one possible candidate is the volume of the seven-dimensional Sasaki-Einstein manifold.
So, but this would be, you need to have a string dual, right?
Weakest is three or only? I mean, I'm...
Sasaki-Einstein. AS4.
Yeah.
Because X7. So it could be weak G2.
Yeah.
N equals 1 weak G2, that's probably where you're at.
But again, that's a... Either way, this is a special case of something that has a geometric dual. So in general, I mean, but that's just it's a guess.
It's a guess, and you know, it's actually lots of work needs to be done there, so that this is an interesting direction to go.
Not a lot is known either about what those gauge theories are, even on something I think as simple as an orbifold. What else would I want to say? Oh yeah, there's a recent paper of Intrilligator et al. Who propose a way of finding R charges in three-dimensional theory for supercharges. In three-dimensional things. And what it is it is basically minimizing coefficients of a two-point function. And they have a very general ground that this should be the thing that singles out the superconformal R symmetry. Now, the relation of that to the C theorem is still unclear, but we actually do have a way, in principle, of figuring out R charges in 3D theories. However, in 3D theories, you know, you don't have these anomalies, you don't have things that you can that are protected that you can actually compute. So in practice, it's not even known how to figure out what those R charges are in three dimensions. By the way, this thing, so they call this tau RR minimization, that is more directly related to the dual of the geometric stuff, Z minimization, which I'll talk about on Thursday. It's very mysterious why. Maybe I should wait to say that on Thursday since I haven't talked about that. But in terms of there's a geometric proposed dual for A maximization that is not at all clear why it's related to A maximization. And if you kind of map that over, that's what these guys did, it's related more closely to minimizing the function coefficient.
Sorry,
are we
talking related to this confusion? Are we talking about N equals 1, N equals 2, or N equals 4 theories?
I'm talking about theories with 4 supercharges. So N equals 1 in 4 dimensions, N equals 2 in 3 dimensions.
So what about high supersymmetry, like high
supersymmetry? I don't know if there's a general... Usually it's... not as pressing to get the R charges because you'll have the higher, the non-abelian
structure. Well, but in four dimensions, I mean, I'm not sure if intuition's first, but I would say in four dimensions, it's much easier to identify N equals 4, N equals 2.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I don't know what the result is for higher supersymmetry in lower dimensions. And in fact, I don't even know what the result is for higher supersymmetry in four dimensions, except that it is much more restricted. I don't know if there's an analogous thing like that. It would be interesting, I think, by the way, to try to see if there's some kind of, if there is something like a maximization even in two dimensions that you could use to prove the C theorem there, and then see if that somehow extends to four dimensions. Even that statement is not.
Well, that's nothing again.
All right, thanks.